Welcome everyone to today's webinar. Great to have everybody on board. Thanks for coming on tonight. As you can see by my screen there, we're actually going to talk about superannuation. Now the reason I want to talk about superannuation tonight is because, well, we're starting off a new year for starters, and that's always a good time to talk about super. But for a lot of you, you know, super is one of those sleeping giants. It's one of those things that some of you have taken on board and gone and set up self-managed superannuation funds and started to think about investing, but some of you haven't. And, you know, there's a number of things that you can do in super that maybe you don't realize. So I want to talk about the type of investment that suit superannuation and, and why you should be looking at those types of investments. There's also been a few little rule changes and things like that. So I thought it's a good time to catch up. And I have my resident superannuation expert here, Clint Ducat. How are you?
Good evening, Dipno. I'm very well, thank you.
Very good. Good to have you on board. I'm actually in Newcastle at the moment, so your hometown.
Yes. So welcome to Newcastle. It's a great place. So, thanks for the invite along.
And I'll be seeing everybody else who wants to come along to a one day that I've got in Newcastle if you're around. I'm actually travelling around Australia at the moment. I've just been in Sydney and I'm off to Adelaide and then to Melbourne for a few days and back up to Queensland and then off to Perth. So if you're around, if you've got any mates who'd like to come and see me at a one day, or I will be around the traps, jump on the website and have a look where the times and dates are, etc. But, I'll be jumping around the country to go and talk to everybody. So, Clint, let's talk super.
Okay, so I'll put a little bit of a presentation together, a bit more advanced than probably what we cover just at the Ultimate Bootcamp. So it's to delve into a little bit more of the process around limited recourse borrowing and how to acquire a property, mm-hmm. but also some of the other more advanced for some people out there that are wanting to be probably potentially a little bit more active and quite detailed with property development opportunities, that sort of thing. How can we use super to cover off in property development, but also just to again go over some of all the little technical details. So the presentation is a little bit technical.
Okay.
But at the same stage, if it is probably more so just to put it out there that the sort of things that you need to know, or all the stuff that you need to just be a little bit aware of and at least ask the right question at the right time, and make sure that you're getting that advice before you're acting on it.
So before we launch into the actual presentation, let's have a little discussion about something that I get asked all the time, and it's to do with setting up a self-managed superannuation fund, which is just going a little bit about what it is. You know, it's just a superannuation fund like everybody else's superannuation fund, except you're the boss. You make the investment decisions, and you've got to, make those investment decisions on some guidelines set out by the Act. But one of the big questions that I get all the time is, how much money do I need before I should go out and, set up my own self-managed superannuation fund?
Yeah, this is the magic question, isn't it? So we get asked the same question all the time, and there's no golden rule for this. It all really does depend on what you're really wanting out of your self-managed super fund, how much control, how much time you're going to invest in that. A lot of the ATO and ASIC and all the like are putting it out there as a figure to be around this $200,000 figure. And the reason behind that is they're looking at the cost difference between potentially running a retail or industry style fund versus running your own self-managed super fund. And that seems to be about the figure that it starts to become more cost effective to potentially be running your self-managed super fund. But then it comes down to, if you can return a higher rate of return by actively managing your own money than having it in, say, a retail fund. Well, it's wise enough as long as you're aware of the ongoing management cost of preparing a tax return and having the fund audited annually. Then you can definitely look at setting up a self-managed super fund, with less than this stated sort of $200,000 figure.
See, I'm probably a little bit more aggressive than the ATO. Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise. And, $200,000 is a lot of money. And, you know, I look at that and say, okay, well, what's the tax office thinking? They're thinking you're going to get the money and you might put it into term deposits and put it into managed funds and play a bit in the share market.
And you just get an average rate of return of, yeah, you know, 5 or 6%.
That's right. Yeah. Whereas I get far more excited about putting it into property, of course, and, you know, with the ability to be able to borrow now and buy a property. If you can get out there and buy a property, now obviously we'll talk about the type of property that you should be buying in superannuation, or what I think you should be buying in superannuation. But, you know, when you get out there and buy a property and it's got, you know, a good yield on it and it's got a bit of growth and things like that, you're going to far exceed any of the stuff that the tax office is talking about. And, you know, you've got control of it. So, you know, in my mind, I'm going to go lower than $200,000. Yeah.
But we've also got to know about, you know, how the lenders are looking at that. What, you know, there is lenders coming through with sort of minimum account balances or rules around how much they would want to see you investing within your self-managed super fund. As some guidelines, obviously, they all have very, very different rules. You know, there's a major bank that has now put their policy in line with, you know, some of the ATO requirements. So that is a minimum fund balance of 200,000, but there's plenty of options that that have no minimum account balance. But a lot of them may want to see at least, say, 10% of the value of the property that you're purchasing retained in the fund as liquidity, as cash, or, you know, liquid investments, instead of investing all of your fund into the one property asset.
So if you had over $100,000, we'll mm-hmm. say, and, you know, a bit more than that, you'd have enough to maybe get into a cheaper property, commercial property, something like that, residential property, whatever it might be, and, you know, still have those kind of guideline limits left in your superannuation fund as cash reserves. And
correct.
And if you're still working and putting more in all the time, that's got to count towards, you know, the, you know, being more advantageous to have your own self-managed super fund.
Yeah, and this is where, you know, it's everyone is in very different circumstances. Some people are obviously a lot younger than others and a lot more time until retirement. They want to start, you know, much earlier and have that time on their side. You know, and all of that needs to be taken into account if they are starting a little bit younger and maybe have a little bit of a lower account balance, but a lot more time and some, you know, good, strong contributions that are coming in, and the idea that, they, you know, a lot more time, you know, that those contributions are going to be made for, you know, a number of years yet, then, yes, it does weigh up that, you know, they can be making that decision a little bit earlier. But I don't think that's a bad rule of thumb to say that, you know, if you were going to buy a cheap price point property of, you know, 200 or 250,000, well, it is only 20 to 25,000 being retained, you know, as liquidity in the fund.
You can do it at that.
Yeah.
Now, to set up a fund, though, you've actually got to have advice by somebody who specializes in superannuation. And it's not just any accountant these days, because all of that authority has been taken away from accountants, hasn't it?
Correct, especially when we, you know, you want advice across a number of things around your insurances and everything that really needs to be taken into account. We're talking superannuation is a financial product, and therefore anything to do with superannuation or a lot of the risk insurances that are owned within super is all financial product advice, which does need to be taken, you know, and advised through a licensed financial planner. But at the same stage, there's a lot of financial planners that really don't specialize in this area either. So it's not just a case of going to any financial planner. You really need to have a look at, you know, someone's specialty and whether they're this is an area that they advise in a lot, or whether they're mainly advising in more the retail space.
And see, that's where it's, you know, they might be able to you might be a financial advisor, but then not have the expertise to talk about property.
True, very true, and yeah. A lot of them are very restricted to talk around property at the best of times, especially when it, you know, is also involved with superannuation as well.
And a lot of financial advisors really only specialize in managed funds.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
So, okay, so Clint, you, mm-hmm. you're a financial advisor.
Correct, yes.
You've come from a very strong mortgage strategy background, because that's how you started with me.
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been with me?
Coming up about 7 to 8 years now, I believe.
7 to 8 years. You actually started in the Ultimate program and then came along and became one of my Platinums.
That is true. That is true. We had the very first Platinum baby, I believe. So,
you did too.
In the early days.
I remember changing her nappy. So, you know, we go back a long way, and you obviously specialize in superannuation. Now you're a certified financial planner. And obviously property is your thing.
Yeah, so look, I don't do the full gamut of financial planning and deal in, you know, a lot of the other pieces. This is the area that I have specialized in. And it was out of a need, really. Over the years, I saw a gap here that clients probably weren't getting the right advice at the right time. And they really needed, you know, the right technical advice, you know, especially when it came to property, and a few of them were being, you know, caught out if they weren't getting that right advice especially when they were looking to go into the borrowing side of things. There's a few key rules which we will go over later on, but that you really need to be aware of and make sure that along the way we take the right steps and we don't get breached, essentially, because it is an environment that that is constantly changing, and we need to keep abreast on some of those changes, and you need, as a responsible trustee, make sure that every decision that you make is compliant, and at the end of the day is going to be ticked off and certified by your auditor.
That's right. Okay, so here's some of the things we're going to cover tonight, some of the tips and traps.
Yeah, we're just going to go through some of that, you know, little detail around that process again, of what's it take to actually acquire a property within super using, you know, super borrowing, etc. Covering, you know, and reviewing that structure. And then we're just going to do a bit more of the more advanced strategies around super, and for some of those are out there that are looking at doing joint ventures and maybe bigger, you know, bigger property transactions. We're going to look at how you could potentially use a self-managed super fund to assist you in those.
So there's been a few changes and releases and things. What's all that about?
Yeah, this is just a bit more of the news if you're out there following some of the news and some of the talk that's sort of out there in the industry. I've just sort of put a couple here on a slide that are sort of hot topic at the moment. One is, over the last sort of 6 or 8 months, the ATO have come out and finally made a ruling around zero interest rate related party loans. So essentially that's when you've got a member funded loan to your super fund. And a lot of those were set up with no interest payable to the member themselves. So really that got around the contribution limits. When you break that down, you really can then, you know, with no interest rate attached, there's no restriction of how much really you can get into the super fund that then can actually be earning that income within that super fund environment. So that's
something that's changed over the years, because there, you know, go back a few years, you used to be able to put $1 million into superannuation.
Correct. As contributions, yeah.
Yeah. And then that then changed, and they gave a deadline on that. And then they came back and said you can only put in $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made it 35,000. No, they made 30. Then they made 35,000.
Yeah. So at least we're going backwards, you know, back up now. We're not going down any further. So, and Dipna's talking about the concessional contributions that you,
which means it's tax deductible to somebody.
Correct. Yeah. But we've also got non-concessional contributions that you can put in, which is after tax money. But again, they're limited to 180,000 per annum. Or we can have a bring forward rule that essentially allows us to get 3 years of non-concessional contributions into super, which would equate to 540,000. But with these zero, you know, related party interest loans, well, there's no real limit on that. If you're then lending in a further $1 million, it's not actually a contribution, it's a loan into the super fund. And with a zero interest rate, therefore, you know, really the super fund's then getting the full benefit of all of that. So the ATO has now sort of cut off that loophole and essentially would then deem, if there is a zero, you know, non-commercial sort of related party loan, they would deem that to be non-arm's length income and therefore taxed at the highest marginal tax rate of 47 cents in the dollar.
Even having said that, though, like if you had a property that came up and it was a bit more than your superannuation fund could afford,
mm-hmm.
it'd be a great thing to you know, buy it in the super fund where it's got the tax advantaged environment. You've got, you know, obviously at preservation age, you've got no tax and no capital gains tax and no tax on the pension. But until then, it's even still concessioned at, you know, 15 cents in income tax and 10 cents for capital gains tax. You could actually lend the money in, charge, you know, you could borrow it against your line of credit, borrow
exactly
it against
right.
the house,
yes.
lend it into the super fund. The super fund could pay the same interest that you're paying on your line of credit.
Yep.
And so it's a net nothing to you outside super, so it's no tax effect. And that then gets enough money into the super fund to go and buy the type of property that you want to go and buy in super fund.
Correct. And there's no issues with that. And the ATO have no issues with that either, because the super fund is paying a commercial rate of interest back to the member, and that's fine. So.
And then if you wanted to, over the years to come, you could, you know, as the years click by, you could use your maximum concessional amount, which is your tax deductible bit, like your 35 or whatever it is, to eat up that loan.
And pay down some of the capital.
Which
essentially is paying you, you know, a bit of an income stream out of the super fund to also be paying back some capital.
And then what that means is that, say, you put, you know, $35,000 of the loan that you lent to the super fund would then be converted from a loan to a contribution.
Correct. Yeah? Yes.
Which means that then outside super, you get a tax deduction for the $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that then goes against reducing your other taxes and, you know, your salary or whatever else.
Yeah, very true.
Great,
very true.
Planning. Like that one a lot.
So, look, as long here is that we're charging a commercial rate of interest, it's fine. If anyone has got a, you know, an existing zero sort of rate interest rate loan in existence and probably haven't had your fund audited this year, just be warned, it will come up and you probably need to revisit that that member funded loan and then just attract a commercial rate of interest to that loan.
Hmm.
Okay. The other one was we had the financial system inquiry that come out with a report with recommendations.
This is terrible.
Yeah. So this wasn't good news. I was actually on the road with Dipner at the time that the report was actually finalised and did come out. But the, you know, these financial system inquiries do come out with, you know, 50 or 60 odd recommendations, and the reality is only sort of 5% from history ever get implemented. But one of the, you know, recommendations that does affect us if this was to be put in place, it was there was a strong recommendation to ban what we call the limited recourse borrowing arrangement, which is essentially the super fund lending, okay, from the Murray report. Since then, there's obviously been a lot of backlash, a lot of big law firms saying that's ridiculous. They really can't ban it in it.
A lot of pollies are bucking up about it too, which means it won't get through.
So, you know, whether it does or not, but we need to, you know, keep an eye on this. I think the biggest risk in the industry now would be if you were considering signing a long off the plan contract, which I don't believe is probably the best strategy for super anyway. So that's the risk. If, you know, be very, very careful signing off the plan contracts while a change could happen like this and you could get caught out. So as long as you're, you know, staying away from off the plan, then and keeping a bit of an eye on what changes does happen, it's just be mindful of this. My personal opinion, I don't think, you know, we will see a ban of super fund lending. We could see some restrictions of some sort, whether they restrict in the future lower loan to value ratios, or whether, you know, they do only allow for commercial property to be bought in super. You know, we're yet to know some you know, maybe some restrictions.
They won't do that. It'll ruin the residential industry. They won't do it.
You know, they may just, you know, bring it back that, you know, a lot of the lenders are also probably pushing the limits here and are asking for personal guarantees. So they might bring it back to a level that it is true limited recourse, so no recourse bar the property asset itself.
That'd be a good thing.
I think that would be a good thing for the industry. So, but watch this space and, you know, just be aware of it. If it was to be taken up.
Yeah.
Look, the other one there was there was another recommendation here for a flat rate of tax across all of superannuation. So that's sort of introducing, instead of having a 15% tax rate for accumulation funds, to have a tax rate across both accumulation and pension. You know, they have tried this in the past once before, and, you know, the rate that was suggested was 7.5%, which it just didn't work when you broke it down, because there's a lot more money in accumulation than there is pension. So they're actually doing themselves out of, you know, out of taxes rather than providing more, you know, more tax for the government. But whether this does happen, we had other recommendations in previous governments to sort of tax the first portion of or essentially have the first portion of $100,000 tax-free in pension phase, and then anything above that to be taxed at the, you know, the same rate of 15% for accumulation. So there's been lots of different suggestions in the past. Again, this is a forever changing environment, but I firmly believe it's always going to be our most tax effective environment. So whatever changes do happen in, you know, in the future, we're still, you know, having as much money within your, you know, your superannuation or self-managed super and taking control of that and using it for your advantage is still going to be in a better taxed environment than having that money owned outside.
That's right. Okay, what else we got here?
Okay, so again, I just wanted to detail out sort of what is the step-by-step sort of process that you would need to follow when you are going through acquiring a property and borrowing. Essentially, you do need to seek advice, like we were suggesting before, from a suitably qualified strategist or advisor that specializes in self-managed super. Again, on one, whether self-managed super fund is the right appropriate vehicle for you, but two, whether borrowing and purchasing property is a suitable strategy. So get
and
that
what
advice.
What type of property?
Yeah, what style of property, given your age again, you know, whether that needs to be focused towards yield and cash flow, which we'll talk about, or whether you've got a little bit more time and it might be a growth style investment. So, you know, we've got to look at what the right type of property for yourself is and the right price point. You know, are you just looking at acquiring one and having some diversification, or is, you know, is your fund large enough that we're going to have, you know, the capacity to maybe even, you know, do multiple property purchases within your self-managed super fund? Step two is to ensure that your SMSF trust deed allows for the borrowing. So this is really commenting probably on someone that already is in the SMSF environment. If you're not, you know, it's going to be okay because we're going to set up a brand new trust deed and we're going to go through the correct process from day one. But if you've got an existing fund that might be a number of years old, you really do need to have that SMS, the fund's trust deed itself reviewed and most likely upgraded. So we've had a number of you know, major changes over the years in around the borrowing, but also in rules around self-managed super, essentially, which really does mean that, you know, these deeds are constantly being upgraded to keep them up with all current legislation. So existing self-managed super funds, especially if you had, you know, your fund in existence prior 2010, you will definitely need a deed of upgrade to bring it up to all the new borrowing rules. Again, you also need to update your investment strategy. So you need to make sure that you've got your investment strategy in place. It takes into account that you're planning to undertake this style of investment with the risk of borrowing and that you've had your insurances reviewed. And there's a few different, you know, key points that investment strategy must take into account. Okay, so really they're the two very, very key documents here. The trust deed must allow for the borrowing, and also the investment strategy must take into account that this is the plan before you actually undertake the purchase. The next step is to determine who's going to be the custodian entity. So this is where it's the only environment that we actually have to set up a separate entity altogether just to hold the legal title of the property. And we will, in a couple of slides, actually go over the structure needed here. This is why it's very different borrowing to your normal borrowing that you may be used to in individuals' names or company name or company trust name. There is limited recourse and very detailed rules that the lender doesn't have access to everything. They don't have access to all the assets in the fund itself. If they are lending the fund the money to acquire the property, they really only have access to that single acquirable asset being the property itself. Okay, so this is where this extra bit more complex structuring needs to be put in place. We need to go out there and obviously source the correct property to purchase, negotiate on price, and have an offer accepted.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing to me there, Clint?
Next slide we need.
Try that.
Sorry.
No, try this. There you go.
There we go. After we've sourced the correct property, we then need to apply for obviously the borrowing. So we need to lodge a loan application with an appropriate lender that offers a super type product. We need to get that sort of approved at the same time as we need to sign and execute this holding trust deed. And we'll go through some of the detail in around executing and dates of execution. We need to get that right depending on which state we're acquiring the property in. But there's some detail around that because of the need at some stage to potentially transfer the property once the borrowing has been paid out, potentially transfer the property back to the super fund, and we just need to get those execution dates correct. After that, we arrange for the holding trustee, which is this custodian trustee, to sign the purchase contract. Okay, so it's not the self-managed super fund that's actually signing your contract of purchase. It is this holding trustee signing it because they're going to hold legal title. But it's the SMSF that provides all the deposit money. It's the SMSF that sets up the bank account. It applies for the loan. So really everything, all the transaction gets done within your self-managed super fund itself. It's just this other legal entity that's going to hold the title, which gives a security to the bank, which is very different to everyday borrowing that most people are used to. And it does confuse a lot of people. And there's a lot of people that do get caught out here by contracting on a property or going to auction and thinking they're going to buy it for their self-managed super fund and then put on, you know, their self-managed super fund on the contract. And essentially that means that, yes, you could acquire that property, but the super fund would have to acquire it purely out of its own funds with no borrowing if it's going to be on contract. So
that's a big mistake people make all the time.
Yes. Yeah. So the next step is to complete the purchase. So we need to use the SMSF money for the deposit. The loan comes obviously from the lender. And then finally, depending on what state you're in, we need to then submit your bear trust deed or custodian trust deed to the relevant state stamp duty office for stamp duty and payable on that deed. Okay, so a lot of discretionary trust deeds in different states will be stamped when they first get set up. A custodian or bear trust deed actually gets stamped once the transaction has occurred, and it now has a property asset because there's a lot of detail that actually goes within that deed in exactly what property it's holding on behalf of the super fund.
I think it's hilarious that I've been out there for 10, 15 years saying, oh my God, guys, you've got to get yourself aware of the legal obligations and the risk associated with having properties in your own name. And I've been on the bandwagon for years. And now that superannuation funds, where, you know, the government, the tax office is saying, we really need to protect your money from yourselves, is insisting on going into a trust.
On very similar structuring that Dibna talks about all the time. It says, look, if you're going to take that extra risk of leverage and borrowing, you must do it this way because we're not going to allow you to
lose it
and risk all your superannuation and open it up to a lending institution. So you must structure it this way that separates that risk, which is very similar. And you must have a lot of them now, which we haven't sort of covered tonight, but having individual trustees versus corporate trustees.
Yep. So all the stuff I talk about outside super,
correct,
they're actually making legislation to do it with your super funds.
And a lot of the banks won't even lend to you if you're an individual trustee. So they make sure that both the SMSF must have a corporate trustee, as well as this custodian bear trust also needs its own corporate trustee.
So here's a bit of a diagram. Do you want to talk people through that?
Yeah, okay. So here's the structure itself. So on the left-hand side, we've got the self-managed super fund itself with the money rolled over into its bank account, let's say. It has a special purpose trustee company. So it has a specially worded constitution that when it comes down to it really just allows it to get a discount on the ASIC annual registration fee. But to get that discount, you do have to have a special purpose trustee company. We then also have the custodian trustee company with this holding bear trust that actually is holding the property asset itself. Okay, so this is where the separation of legal title is held by this custodian trustee company. We have the SMSF borrowing the money from the bank, let's say, or it can be member funded like we were talking before. We have the SMSF that's paying all the deposit and costs for the purchase itself. This holding bear trust actually doesn't require to have a bank account at all. It doesn't need a bank account. It has no further ongoing reporting requirement. It essentially, once it sits on title and holding that legal title, everything else will be done by the self-managed super fund in its entirety. So it's only just that it is holding legal title. So the lease document itself, depending if it's commercial or residential, but the lease does have to be in the name of the custodian trustee company, but the rental income has to be paid to the super fund. Okay, and a lot of management agents that might not be used to this either, that can be confusing when essentially they're putting one name, one legal name on a lease document, but essentially directing the rental income to another legal entity. But it has to be done that way. And finally, then the lender takes security over the property itself and only has limited recourse over that property asset. So if essentially the, you know, the mortgage wasn't being repaid and for whatever reason the lender needed to call their loan in, they only can really sell down that property if they don't get all their funds back. They have no limit, no recourse over further assets of the self-managed super fund alone. But very cheeky, they are at times, if you're borrowing sort of the higher loan to value ratios, they are asking for personal guarantees of the directors of the custodian trustee company, which opens up, you know, any assets that are, you know, personally in your name.
Mm.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. So this is what we were talking about before about, you know, borrowing and how the different states are a little bit different. Do you want to go through this?
Yeah. So most of the country being New South Wales, Victoria, Tasmania, ACT, South Australia and Queensland, the purchaser's name on the contract is the trust, the custodian company. Okay. It should refer, you know, at times as trustee. Oh, sorry, it shouldn't refer as trustee for the SMSF. It is just the custodian company. It can refer to as trustee for the Bear Trust, and that will just depend on what state you're in as well. Some states like New South Wales only really legally require just the trustee company to be on the contract, whereas other states will have the full name. Some of the other different states, really being Northern Territory and Western Australia, are the ones that have some different wording needed to be on that contract. So the Northern Territory, it needs to essentially suggest that it's the holding trustee or custodian trustee proprietary limited as trustee for the name of the holding trust, which is this Bear Trust that we talk about, as holding trustee for the SMSF trustee, as trustee for the super fund itself.
Good Lord, following that's, by a ABN. Of, that's a lot of big mouthful there.
So keep your name short, otherwise that will take up three or four lines in itself, okay? So that's in the Northern Territory. Western Australia, just the word for needs to be used between the holding trustee's name and the SMSF trustee. So we actually have to put in the holding trustee proprietary limited for the super fund trustee proprietary limited. So it is suggesting that it's holding it on behalf of the super fund.
Okay.
So they're the two states to be really mindful of, that there is a difference in the Northern Territory and WA. So when paying the deposit, again, you know, the deposit must be paid from the SMSF's bank account. If not, if you went to auction and didn't have access or didn't have your checkbook for your SMSF's bank account and you're just going to pay that deposit out of yourself, by yourself, but still try to acquire this property as an SMSF purchase, be very careful because that deposit could be seen as a contribution, and therefore, depending on your history of contributions and the amounts, that could breach your contribution limit. So be very careful that all costs associated with the purchase need to be paid by the SMSF's bank account directly. Otherwise, they will be added to, you know, be seen as a contribution to the super fund itself.
Thanks for that one.
Yep.
Oh, sorry.
So purchase contract. So again, this is comes down to we've got to be very mindful that a self-managed super fund, when borrowing, can only acquire what we call a single acquirable asset. Okay, so it only can acquire one legal title, and therefore there's different styles of properties that are out there that do list what we call fixtures and chattels as part of the contract. Fixtures are part of the land and therefore pass with the real estate itself. They form part of this single acquirable asset that the SMSF is purchasing and can be used to borrow the money. Okay, so this could be a property that does come with a car park, but the car park can't be sold separately. So it's all under the one single acquirable asset. The chattels are separate from the land, so and they are each themselves a single acquirable asset. And as such, depending on, you know, on the contract itself, would need to have a separate loan and actually a separate entity, separate bear trust to acquire each chattel. Now, when we're talking about that, that could be furniture. Again, it could be a lot of commercial property will come with a associated car park that is an individual title itself as well, and would need to be acquired separately or acquired by the SMSF directly out of cash funds. Okay, but again, they need to be then separated on the contract. So this is where we need to have a solicitor on board that understands the detail. Otherwise, your SMSF loan just won't go through when you know, when there is multiple titles. And again, it does depend on, you know, the property that you're purchasing could be, you know, two lots on you know, two titles, and that style of property unfortunately just won't be able to be acquired by the SMSF under one borrowing arrangement. It would have to be set up as two separate borrowings to acquire that sort of property.
So let's just play with that a little bit. Let's say you're buying a residential house on a double block,
mm-hmm.
Okay? You could still buy that, but you'd need two contracts, two bear trusts, two loans.
That is correct, yes.
Right. If the house was halfway across the second title, that's not going to happen, is it?
No, that's not going to happen. If, and it comes down to then the detail in around the contract, if that property is deemed that could never be sold individually, okay, so there's some properties that will come with, you know, could be a large farm that comes with multiple titles, you know, and therefore always going to be a single acquirable asset. So at times some of them can be acquired if it is deemed that it could not be sold separately.
Yeah.
Okay. But if there's any chance of that property being able to be sold as two separate lots, essentially, as Dipna suggests, we would then need to acquire it under two separate bear trust arrangements, two separate borrowings to acquire one single title each.
That also means, though, that in your self-managed superannuation fund, as far as a strategy is concerned, that you, if you're going to borrow, you can't do subdivisions, you can't do stratas, yeah. You can't do any kind of separation of asset strategy at all.
Yeah, because you would be breach of the single acquirable asset rule.
If there's borrowing.
If there's borrowing, correct. That's so right. If you own the property, and there's some of the other ownership structures that we will talk about through unit trusts, and this is where some of those sort of strategies can be undertaken. But if you are borrowing directly using a super fund loan or a limited recourse borrowing arrangement, you wouldn't be able to, you know, subdivide that property, because you would then be creating multiple titles within that one bear trust and would put you at instant breach.
It seems a ridiculous rule, but that's what it is.
Yes, very true.
Now, we've got a question here. What's a chattel? You're using jargon again.
Okay. So a chattel, some of the, you know, it's not a fixed object to the property, so it might be just an addition. An example of that could be that the property is being sold fully furnished and the furniture that, you know, itself is considered a chattel. Okay, as an example. Okay, so one of the other tips and traps are, you know, around timing, and it's sort of timing of the correct execution of this bear trust or holding trust. If the timing is wrong, essentially the SMSF could end up paying stamp duty three times instead of only once. So we need to get this correct. And again, each state is a little bit different. What could happen, you could have, you know, stamp duty on the original contract. You could have then stamp duty on the sale. On the holding trust deed itself. So when you're executing or stamping that holding trust deed, if not executed correctly, there could be full stamp duty instead of concessional stamp duty. And then another stamp duty eventually, once the loan has been paid back and you were transferring that property to the SMSF, there could be full stamp duty payable then as well if this is not done correctly. So as a guideline, in New South Wales, Tasmania and ACT, the purchase contract must be signed and dated before the holding trust deed. Okay, so our advice here, the best way to go is to actually have the execution date of the holding trust deed to be the same date as the contract, and that's the safest way to go. And essentially that crosses over then into South Australia, Queensland and the Northern Territory, which the holding trust deed must be signed and dated before the purchase contract, or on the same day as the purchase contract. So again, it's much safer to have those signed and executed on the same day as the contract. Mm. Western Australia and Victoria, you can sign the purchase contract in any order. So there's no real detail around the dates there.
Got a question there for you.
Is a hot water system a chattel? No, look, I think that's a fixed, you know, most properties will come with a hot water system. So it's a fixed fixed asset of the property itself. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one final note. The reason that the description of the property in a holding trust deed is important. So this is where the holding trust deed isn't just like a discretionary trust deed that's a book of words that could do multiple investments in the future, etc. It is worded specifically around the property that you're purchasing, and therefore that property address gets embedded in the holding trust deed. And the reason around this is that when the borrowing is paid out, the property can receive a concessional stamp duty on the transfer back to the self-managed super fund eventually. And legislation up to date has really been that once this loan has been paid out, the property will need to be transferred back to the SMSF, and if it doesn't, it would be treated as an in-house asset, saying that the ATO has finally come out after years of the industry suggesting that that's a bit crazy. Why can't it just be, you know, continually held by the custodian, and have issued a draft ruling suggesting that it's fine for, you know, for the custodian trustee just to hold that asset, and it's probably better from an asset protection point of view anyway.
Totally better from an asset protection perspective.
To keep that legal ownership separated away from the super fund. But just realise that if you, whenever that property is held by this custodian, all of the same restrictions, the borrowing restrictions, will remain. So even though the borrowing might be paid out, it's being held in trust for the super fund, and therefore the same single acquirable asset, you wouldn't be able to subdivide. So there's still some restrictions there. So that's when occasionally if, 15 to 20 years down the track, the borrowing has been paid out, this is a style of property that, you know, you would maximise the sale of that property if you could subdivide it, well, you may need to transfer it back to the super fund just to complete the, you know, the subdivision or the like.
Yeah. Okay, so let's look at some of the cool things you can do. This is a bit more advanced than just getting out there and buying property. But yeah, probably before we go here, we should talk about what kind of properties best for people to be buying. So, I mean, I love inside superannuation, high yielding investments, but I'm cash flow mad. So having a property that's got a high yield. And this is why I love commercial property for superannuation, because they definitely have a higher yield, you know, a higher return from a cash flow than a residential. And if you don't do commercial, then my preference is, you know, to go and do a multiple income stream property, residential property. So, again, you've got that higher yield coming in. Or, you know, just one that returns really, really well. And the reason I like it that way is because, you know, in retirement and pension phase, et cetera, you know, it's the income that you're actually after. That, you know, you're going to be living on that income. And if over the time it's sitting in superannuation, you pay it off and get debt free, well, all of that income is going to be your income as a pension tax free at the moment, the way the rules are. So that makes a lot of sense. However, if you are much younger, then, you know, perhaps some higher growth assets might be more advisable, because, you know, then you can capitalize on the increase in value of the asset with a view to perhaps in retirement or, you know, at preservation age, selling that asset, move across to pension phase, sell the asset, capital gains tax free, and then move the money then into something that's more high yielding.
More income producing.
Yeah.
Correct. And this is where, yeah, it's very dependent on the time frame you've got to retirement. And we try to strategize with you around looking at the right style of, you know, price point, the right lending ratio, the right sort of yield that we can try to get to having that property potentially paid, you know, significantly down, if not paid totally off when you do get to retirement, because then we're going to maximize the cash flow coming from that investment, that's tax-free, and it really is becomes a tax-free pension for life if we can get that right and have that that property and use the super environment, which allows your, you know, your super contributions as well as allows the rent and allows at the end of the day, if the property is positive cash flow, which we want in super, we've got a lot more after-tax dollars here as well, because while you're in accumulation, you know, we've got 85 cents in every dollar after tax to be paying down debt. So this is where the momentum can really kick into overdrive, and you know, debt consolidation and debt payment down can really speed up if you're going after these more higher yielding cash flow style properties. So that's what we see that most people for super are definitely after, is it is about the income and be able to pay down the loans as quick as possible, you know, within that environment, and then really time it correctly that we can then, when we're going into pension phase, we can maximize our cash flow result.
It's a bit of a question for you there.
So the question is, what's your advice with SMSF with a low balance? Would regional positive cash flow properties at a lower price point be okay? Obviously, it totally depends on, you know, what are we talking with the low balance? How low is that balance? But yes, it's again, no doubt, you know, regional in a solid location that has multiple, you know, industry that's producing, you know, good cash flow, whether that's a multiple, you know, income residential property or commercial property with a solid lease. Again, picking the right price point is the key here, that we're got the right price point, we've still got liquidity in the fund, and, you know, that investment's going to perform for you. So again, it's a very case-by-case basis, and I'd be more than happy to have a bit of a one-on-one strategy session at any point of time. But you've just got to pick the right price point for you.
Another question there?
Okay, so another question. So if you're young, say 35 years of age, when is it worth setting up an SMSF?
Depends how much money you got.
Yeah, correct. It really does depend on what we're starting with. Yeah, look, most people are, you know, in accumulation phase, starting to set up SMSFs around, you know, mid-30s to, you know, to 40. When we're getting to 40 or, you know, 45 to 50, it becomes a big part of everything that they're doing. They're, you know, they're really focused on maximizing, you know, what their super's doing, because they're a lot closer to obviously receiving the bigger benefit, okay?
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, that's where you might not, you might be a little bit disheartened because you've only got a little bit of superannuation there at the moment. But the thing with that is, you know, you go out there and do a deal outside super and you make a chunk of money. You know, perhaps at your age, the best thing might be to maximise your contributions, get into super, and you do that over a couple of years and bingo, now you're up there and you can start investing in, you know, get a nice little commercial property sitting
or,
in there.
Or, you know, or talk to other family members, talk to mum and dad. Yeah. Talk to mum and dad and see how much they've got in super. Are they currently self-managing, because you can join their fund as well. So, you know, super can be a very family-orientated thing as long as we don't go over the maximum four members. So, you know, it could be a case of, and then it doesn't really matter what your, you know, your fund balance is. You could have $20,000 or $30,000 if you're also joining a fund, you know, with your parents, let's say, that makes it, you know, much more economical, and you could have, you know, three or four members all pooling their funds together and therefore getting a bigger benefit. So that'd be a question. And later on, you know, there's lots of strategies we can always, you know, actually roll out of one self-managed super fund to your own self-managed super fund down the track. You know, you're not stuck in there forever. And a lot of strategies that can be looked at from a family orientated point of view as well.
Or two or three of your mates get together and do one as well.
True. Yeah. We have a lot of business owners coming together that may be in business already, looking at buying a commercial premises, and a lot of times they would set up a standalone fund together just to sort of hold that commercial property, and they could still also have, you know, individual family related sort of funds with their wife or the like. So they're actually running two separate self-managed super funds, one with their business partner and one with their own family as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to just go through sort of three higher level strategies. If you are very active in property and looking at using a super, you know, a little bit more active instead of sort of the long-term environment that a lot of people would. So if you're, you know, into property development already, doing joint ventures, starting to do some bigger transactions, these are some of the bit higher level strategies that that could be undertaken to help out with, you know, with more active property investment. So what we're going to cover is one, acquiring essentially a development site, you know, using the limited recourse borrowing arrangement that we have covered this evening, obtaining that development approval, and then on selling. So on selling either to a third party, so your super fund's going to achieve the uplift of that DA approved site, or this is where your super fund can actually sell that property, or you can acquire that property off yourself to then go through with the development. So there's no restrictions around you acquiring a residential property off your super fund as long as it's done on commercial terms and market rates, where there is definitely some restrictions around your self-managed super fund acquiring residential property off yourself. Okay, so we're going to cover that strategy in a little bit more detail. We're going to talk about then the two different types of unit trust environments that self-managed super funds can invest in, their related party unit trusts and what we call unrelated party unit trusts. Okay.
Okay, let me just come over here and I'll move this down for you, and then we'll come back and do some more questions in a minute.
Yeah. So the first strategy there that we have got some clients looking to do is essentially instead of just acquiring a long-term buy and hold within their self-managed super fund, they're looking at something that they can value add by just obtaining a development approval. We're not going to be able to go through with the development itself. It's simply by acquiring a site that has development potential, obtaining that approval, and then on selling either to yourself to go through with the development or on selling to a independent third party. Okay, so the rules here are we just got to be careful we don't change the underlying asset. Okay, so we can't buy existing residential property with a house on it and then go and knock down the house and now just have a vacant block of land. You've actually have then deemed to be of changing that underlying asset. The same rules do apply when we, even in some of the longer term investments, we can't go and, you know, buy a residential property and then turn it into a doctor's surgery, let's say. So whatever we do buy originally, whether it's residential or commercial, does need to stay within that asset class. Mm-hmm. Once in this, back to the DA and on sell type strategy, once we've obtained that approval, the property can be sold to, again, an unrelated party, or you can purchase that property as long as it is at market rates. And we've got to make sure that the super fund gets a return on, you know, in the investment it's made. You know, all of that DA cost can be made by that super fund itself. And as long as that super fund is, you know, getting a good return on what it's invested in, it can on sell it to, you know, to the either the member themselves to go through with that development or any unrelated party. So a few considerations here you just need to be mindful of is SMSF can't purchase off a related party unless it's business real property, which I covered, cannot complete the development itself. Okay, so it's only to obtain that development approval and then must on sell it to go through with that development. Must all be at market rates and meet the sole purpose test. So again, as the responsible trustee of your self-managed super fund, you've got to make sure that you're making sure you are putting enough benefit to the super fund itself, and that, you know, and there'll be independent valuations need to be done to make sure that you know, the property is being sold on an arm's length basis. Again, also make sure we update the fund's investment strategy to take, you know, into account the style of investment that you're going to make, and sort of detailed extensive minutes going through the process when you're acting on behalf of this property and you know, maybe, you know, your super fund signing DA approvals, etc. We've just got to keep a lot of detail in there.
Really important to do that. Make sure that, you know, no matter what the strategy is, you know, Clint says, yeah, that's fine to do the strategy. Please make sure, and he'll make sure anyway, but that you've got the investment strategy changed so that you can actually do it before you do it. Even though, you know, it might just be a piece of paper, it changes the rules completely if you don't get it right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so this is where, I mean, I love this strategy. Absolutely love it. This is one of my favorite strategies where, you know, you buy a site and you, in the super fund, you get the DA for it. And then you, you know, you get the DA all through, all ready to go. And then you on sell it. I call it land banking. You on sell it to either somebody else or to one of your own trusts. And, you know, in doing that, that then gives you a DA approved site that's ready to go. You know, so you're kind of setting yourself up. Yeah, it has to be at market rents, and you've got to pay stamp duty, and it's got to be above board. The superannuation fund's got to make money and all that kind of stuff. But it's a great way to set up your next project if you're active outside super. And the other thing that I like about it is that that the way you can actually contract on it outside super, say you've got the DA ready inside your super fund, you could actually take an option over the property to buy it with the contract attached, which that's what you do with an option. And then you can go through, and in your option agreement, you can have that you can start pre-sales, you know, if it would require mm-hmm, pre-sales. Mm-hmm. So you could go out and get the whole thing totally pre-sold before you even have to pay for it outside super and pay interest rates and whatever else, and your super fund's basically holding it for you.
Correct. If you're a developer, you know the benefit of you know, the cost saving to have those sites ready to go, and therefore all your funds outside of super can be, you know, utilized for, you know, current developments. And this is a way to, you know, have that next DA approved site ready to go. But yes, there's some, you know, some extra cost in there, that there is a second stamp duty, and just as long as you're mindful of all of those sort of things, we need to, it is a cost of doing business and being a developer and sort of having that next site coming through.
And obviously the superannuation fund can actually pay for all the DA and BA costs. It can be, because that's part
correct.
Of increasing the value of the property to the super fund.
That's the strategy for the super fund, is to increase its value. So that's what we're detailing in the investment strategy. Our plan is to obtain a development approval here that will increase the value of the property and then is going to on-sell it.
It's a strategy that I call land banking, and I like it.
Yes.
What's the next one?
Okay, so this is where we cover the two different types of unit trust type structures. So an SMSF can invest in a related party unit trust. So this can be a unit trust that you might have 50% owned by your super fund, and the other 50% could be owned by your family trust, let's say, and that unit trust goes and acquires a property. But these trusts essentially are what we refer to as non-geared, and the technical term is a 1322C unit trust. But there can be no gearing within the unit trust itself. Okay, so this is more for, you know, you might borrow against your family home to acquire the, you know, the 50% of the units in the unit trust. So the borrowing is secured against your home. Whatever property asset the unit trust purchases itself, there can be no security, you know, given out by that that property itself. Okay, so there's more of a cash sort of strategy from your super fund and doing a joint venture with your super fund, but there's no way to actually borrow within that environment. So if you are cashed up or you know strong asset position that you are able to do that, obviously the benefit, depending on the percentage ownerships out of that unit trust, will be paid out in those direct percentage basis. So if it is a 50-50 environment, then your super fund's gonna be repaid 50% of the capital on completion of the project, but also 50% of the profit. And so, you know, so would you as an individual or a family trust, etc. Okay, so this is where there is control over this trust structure as a related party group, whether it's you and your family trust, or you and your brother or brother-in-law, etc. So any related parties would be deemed as be grouped the control of this trust. So if there is be seen as there's a controlling party or group of party group, then it's going to be deemed as a 1322C unit trust, and as long as it undertakes the same sort of rules in under the CIS Act, and must maintain its compliance under the CIS Act, which again means that there can be no charge taken over the assets of the trust itself, must abide by all the SMSF in-house asset rules. So therefore it is unable to invest in another entity. So you can't set up a unit trust that then invest in another company or the like. So it only can, you know, make a direct property investment. It can't go and invest in another legal entity itself. But be very careful if you do get it wrong and lose the compliant status of the 1322C status. The consequences can be dire. So you would be deemed to be investing in an in-house asset, and obviously there's a number of fines and you'd have to unwind that very, very quickly. Okay, so that's more for purely if you're just going to invest with family members and or yourself, and wanted to, you know, do it within a sort of a totally outright scenario with no further borrowing. So no borrowings within this case.
Yeah. So this might be your super and your parents' super, if they didn't want to put in any borrowings, could go out and buy property together, and it'd be a proportion between,
And look, also if your super fund was going to go buy a property outright, it actually would be our advice that we do set up this type of trust, so a 1322C unit trust that is actually acquiring the property itself cash, and that just also gives us our asset protection that we don't want really any direct property owned in the super fund. So we would structure it this way, and your super fund would be 100% unit holder of the unit trust. Okay, but it does separate out the legal nature of that new property. Okay.
This next one's I like more.
Okay, so this is where it gets a little bit more fluid of what you can and can't do here, but the restrictions are that we've got to make sure that there is no controlling party. So this is where essentially you are doing a JV or business partners are coming together, and there can be no related party or related party group owning more than 50% of the units. Okay, if there's anyone owning 51%, it would be deemed essentially a controlled unit trust, like the previous slide. So it can come down to just two parties coming together, but they must own obviously 50% each. If there's more than two parties, we could have scenarios of three parties coming together, owning a third each, or one party could own 50% and the other two parties 25% each, as long as any one related party group doesn't own more than the 50%, so therefore gives it control. So if there's no control, essentially deemed a private unrelated party unit trust, then it has a lot.
What's a related party? Like, you and I, we're not really in business together, but we're associates. Is that a related party?
So there's a lot of grey area around business relationships and the like, but partnerships would definitely be considered a related parties. It's very similar to Dipner's three generations in a family trust. So three generations around your family group would definitely be all deemed related parties
and associated entities.
And your associated entities. So any trust structure that you're a beneficiary of, any company that you're a director of. And or any of your individual related, so it could be a cousin's company would actually be part of that related party group. Okay.
But other than that, it's a great way for, two or three separate individuals to come together and buy a property and be able to borrow where, normally you perhaps wouldn't have been able to.
Yeah. So, again, look, the considerations here, that this sort of transaction definitely needs to be at a commercial sort of nature. A lot of the retail banks, as soon as they would see that there is significant SMSF ownership within that unit trust, probably wouldn't understand that, or essentially it's the easiest way for them not to do the deal, rather than have their sort of retail legal teams look through all the documentation and make sure it's correct. So really these sort of transactions are done at a bit bigger level, and definitely more of a development sort of we're talking maybe building, six or eight townhouse type transactions. Okay. So it's not really for going to acquire your little splitter block, that you're going to subdivide. It is about, two or three parties coming together with experience doing a higher level development deal, but we could have some, super fund ownership in here. Okay. Mm. So this is where I've got sort of a scenario just to sort of make it come together. Let's say we did have three unrelated investors or business partners that are coming together. They're wanting to complete a development project of 14 townhouses. They need $1.2 million of cash funds to be injected, but then a further $2.8 million will be obtained through sort of development finance to complete the project. So sort of a total cost of $4 million. One way that they could do it is that investor one could have $400,000 he's got available in his family trust that he's willing to invest in this unit trust that's going to undertake the development. Investor two could have borrowed their $400,000, let's say, from equity in their home, and they're also able to subscribe to units in the unit trust with their $400,000 contribution. But investor three might be a little bit short, and he has $200,000 sort of cash available to invest, but also has a self-managed super fund. And in this scenario, I've sort of suggested a $500,000 self-managed super fund, and that he'd be quite happy to have some of his super fund monies invested in the unit trust as well. So, therefore, as we see, investor one would subscribe to So we have sort of a unit trust environment here of 120 units, and a third of those units would be owned and subscribed by Investor One. Investor Two also subscribed to his 40 units with a value of 400,000, but Investor Three would have two allocations of units, 20 units being 200,000 as you know himself individually or his family trust, and then that's when his self managed super fund could come in and acquire and use 200,000 of its money to acquire the last 20 units, allowing him to bring up his 400,000 contribution to the unit trust, therefore giving it the funding that it needs to go through with this development. Okay. Again, the more ownership we've got here in super, a little bit trickier it's probably potentially going to be to get through the banks. And this is just a constant area that we're keeping a a close eye on and liaising with the banking institutions. And again, it really does need to be at this sort of bit higher higher level for the the commercial bankers to understand it, number one, and for it to get through to the higher legal teams that also is going to understand the detail of the legislation. Okay, so again, before going into any of this more advanced strategy, you really need to talk someone through what your plans are and go through the actual detail. And again, this is where the best advice with anything to do with superannuation, really the best advice is to get advice, and that's where I'd be more than happy to have a one-on-one sort of strategy session with yourself, with anyone sort of looking to go into the more, more advanced strategies and or, looking at that to roll into self-managed super and whether that's appropriate for them or not.
It's a bit of a question here. It says, you mentioned that the superannuation fund can't purchase off a related party, but you also said your self-managed superannuation fund can purchase a property from yourself. Please explain. That's actually not quite right. What we said was that you can't buy, the superannuation fund can't buy a property off a related party if it's residential. A superannuation fund can buy a property off a related party if it's commercial, and that's a big difference. Don't ask me why it's like that. It's stupid, I know, but that's what it is.
And the definition is actually business real property. So, yeah. Which other things can come into that? There's
a business runs out of it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Like even a big, extensive farm. That is actually a business. It even could have a residence on there. But the primary nature of this property is that it's a business real property. It's running a business enterprise. Okay. Down to any sort of commercial style property, being office space or industrial, etc., would all come under that business real property definition.
Another thing I want to clarify here before I finish this question is that you can buy anything off your super fund.
Correct.
But you're only limited to business real property being able to be bought off yourself by your super fund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's no restrictions of you acquiring either a residential or a commercial property off your super fund, but there is very much a restriction that your super fund cannot acquire a residential property off yourself.
Yeah. This is a funny question, or not a funny question, no question is a funny question, but it's a different question. What happens to a property if the self-managed superannuation fund is the rent has been used to fund someone's retirement and they die? Does it pass into the estate like other personal or trust assets?
Okay, so this is where we need to self-managed super fund needs to have binding death nominations put in place here.
Which means you've got to say what's going to happen when you die.
Correct. It's really directing your superannuation to whoever you want to obviously have access to that. But at the same stage, a lot of that really does need to be paid out in cash money. So when you do pass away, it does mean that assets potentially may need to be sold and paid down for that money to be paid out of your superannuation to your beneficiaries. Okay.
Very good.
Again, that's there's a lot of estate planning strategy that can be taken into account. Very different for each circumstance, but it's something that we do need to look into long term for all clients and have a detailed estate planning sort of strategy there as well. But very important for everyone with superannuation to have the binding death nominations up to date and in place as well.
Mm. Question here says, are there any restrictions or difficulties to set up a self-managed superannuation fund when you're unemployed?
No, not at all. So there's no restrictions. You're free to go and set up a self-managed super fund, employed or not. It may just mean that if we're considering borrowing within super, it is that employment that is providing our contributions to super, which help out with the ability to borrow. But if you're looking just to go into the self-managed super fund space and roll over existing money that you've got in retail super and be able to do strategy, property strategy within that, there is no restriction if you are unemployed.
And the last question here is, can you put a granny flat at the back of a self-managed superannuation fund asset if you borrow it?
That's a very good question. And there was a lot of confusion around this early in the day. And where the restrictions around borrowing is where we're seen to use the borrowed money for improving the asset or fixing up the asset, essentially. Okay, so we can put a granny flat on the back of a property owned in an SMSF, but it must be paid for directly out of the super fund. Okay,
so you've got to have the cash flow. You can't borrow the money to go and do it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So if you your super fund has got the cash, and as long as putting a granny flat is not seen as changing the underlying asset, you've still got a residential property, just maximizing that investment. We just can't borrow to do it. So we can't do any construction, any type of construction style lending within super. We also can't increase the borrowings either. Okay. So once you've got borrowings, and let's say the property increased in value or you put the granny flat on there, unfortunately we can't go back and revalue that property and increase the borrowings. Whatever we really take out initially will be the level of borrowings that needs to be maintained.
The question here is there any books that you could recommend which might introduce someone to self-managed superannuation fund requirements? Maybe you and I should write one.
That'd be a good idea.
Why don't we co-author a book?
Sounds good. We've touched on a couple of new books, but there's probably a lot more detail.
Add another one to the list. I mean, look, there's stuff in the home study course, and there's the audios on the ultimate boot camp that we do. There's an audio where you and I do the superannuation, and that's a pretty good introduction, really. Yeah. It's an audio, it's not a book, but.
I've also got guides that I can email out with, which is introductions to super and all the like as well. So
yeah.
There's plenty of information out there. There's also some very good, if you're already within the environment and feel that you need to get more educated, there's some very good courses also being run that you can, through the Chartered Accountants Association, et cetera, that you can do, free courses.
That are very responsibility.
Yeah, it's very educational and it's actually a really good thing to be seen as you educating yourself. So it's something that is directed now by the ATO. If anyone is sort of doing the wrong thing, the ATO suggests that you must go and do this course to get yourself educated. I think it's a good thing for all trustees to potentially go through that that process themselves and educate themselves around your responsibilities of being a trustee, because at the end of the day, the buck lies with you.
That's right. And there's Clint's email there. He's the superannuation fund expert. So if you've got any other questions or anything else like that, there's his email address there. And thank you so much for coming on and spending the night talking about superannuation.
Well, thank you for the invite. And
one of your favourite topics.
Good to see you back in Newcastle. So.
That's right. I haven't been here for a few years. So, yes, I'm here to talk to everybody tomorrow for a full day. Okay, guys, well, thanks heaps and thanks, Clint, and we shall catch you again in 2 weeks' time with the Q&A and send in all your questions, because we do like to have the written questions first, which gives us the ability to be able to, do any research if we need to go through and answer those questions. So thanks again, guys, and we shall talk to you again very, very soon. Bye for now.
Bye, all.